The start of the week and plenty on the radio, from three generations of Irish women dealing with racism to the importance of bicycle helmets on our roads and an avalanche of calls about breast cancer on the live line. This is Playback Daily. I'm Carol Moran, and here's what you might have missed.
I was told I had stage 2 breast cancer. I had a partial mastectomy and lymph node removal.
The family story is my granny married a black man in the 60s. Which at that time was actually illegal.
The rapidly progressing digitalisation of society, it presents endless new opportunities for cyber criminals, and they do take advantage of the situation.
And we'll start here. During the weekend, we heard the news of the death of Girls Aloud singer Sarah Harding at the age of 39. In the afternoon, Philip Boucher Hayes was inundated with calls from women wanting to share their experiences of breast cancer on the live line. Here's Katie Louise. She was diagnosed with breast cancer at the age of 30. And as she tells Philip, she wasn't checking her breasts for cancer because she thought she was too young.
No, I never checked my breasts, ever. I used to read about it, but I was never inclined to check them.
That's an old person's thing. That's a 50, 60-year-old
yeah,
woman's concern.
Didn't think it would affect me at 30 or before that.
And what happened? Tell me.
I was breastfeeding my daughter. That breast used to get a bit achy when I was feeding her, and I just assumed it was a blocked milk duct because I was breastfeeding. And I found the lump. I ignored it. I said it to friends and family, and they all kind of said, oh, sure, you'll be fine. Oh, you're breastfeeding. It's probably nothing. But I couldn't stop thinking about this lump. My gut was telling me it was more. It was something. So, and I didn't really want to go to the doctor because I didn't want to waste the time because it was probably going to be nothing. But I just couldn't stop worrying about it. So I went to the doctor. And I was told this, I have no family history, I'm only 30, breastfeeding, it's probably nothing, just to try feed a lot on that side to try and empty the duct. So I did that, and I went back again and I said, I really need you to send me for a breast check.
Now hang on, what had happened between going the first time and coming back the second time? Had your conscience just nagged and nagged at you?
Oh yeah, I couldn't sleep, I was so worried. It was just my gut feeling was telling me.
Okay.
Go again, go get a check.
But the advice, and this is not casting an aspersion on your doctor at all, the advice was, no, you're young, there's no family history, you're really such a low-risk kind of person.
Yeah.
But fair play to you, you listened to your body and you said, no, I think I know a little bit better on this occasion.
Yeah, you have to listen to your body.
And for the benefit of anybody else, Katie Louise, who's listening to this, describe that pain. Was it very localised or was it just a generalised kind of ache?
It was just an ache. It wasn't a pain. It was just an ache.
That just wasn't there in the other breast.
Yeah.
And was it worse as your breast filled up and you needed to feed, or was it the same kind of pain all the time?
No, it was the same.
All right. So you got a referral, and this is the kind of really, really scary thing here. Back in what point in 2019?
April 2019.
And when would that appointment have actually come good for you?
June 2021.
So 2 years and 2 months later. If you had gone that route and if you hadn't gone privately, do you think you'd still be with us?
No, it's so scary. It made me sick at the thought that so many women wait for these appointments. They get told they have to wait. I didn't meet the criteria for to be seen any quicker. And that's why I found my own doctor and I went myself privately. It's scary.
Thank God you were in the privileged position that you were able to do that. But good God.
I mean, I wasn't. I'm a single mom of 4 children. I wasn't. My brother happened to put me on his health insurance to get my wisdom teeth out only at the start of that year. So I was so lucky to have it at the time. Now, health insurance is very expensive, but it kept me alive.
Well done, the brother.
Yeah.
And Katie Louise spoke about her diagnosis.
I was told I had ductal carcinoma.
Okay. And can you explain to me how serious a diagnosis that is or isn't?
It's crazy. I actually, when I was diagnosed, I didn't take it in. My friend told me, my friend was like, do you realise what they've just told you? I heard the word carcinoma. I didn't know that meant cancer. And I had loads of mammograms that done and biopsies. I'd loads done that day. And it took a long time for it to hit me.
And how advanced was it?
It was the earliest stage of breast cancer. So I was very lucky.
Oh my God.
Very, very lucky.
And if you hadn't been breastfeeding and you hadn't been kind of paying attention to that region of your body, do you think you would have ignored it for longer?
I don't think I wouldn't have found it for a long time because I never, ever checked my breast.
And so what has happened since then? What was your treatment?
I had a mastectomy. I was very lucky. I didn't need chemotherapy or radiotherapy. I just had a full mastectomy and all those results came back clear. They managed to take all the cancer out. So although having a mastectomy is huge, but I was very lucky that I didn't need to go to chemo or radiotherapy.
Okay. The operation was enough.
It was, yeah.
And how invasive was that mastectomy? I mean, how changed do you feel?
Oh, I'm totally changed. It's been a hard 2 years trying to get used to my new body and coming to terms with losing my breast. It's life-changing.
Well, that's Katie Louise there, and we'll have more breast cancer stories from the Live Line later in the programme. And on Today with Claire Byrne, a mistaken email address gives us an insight into the horror for some people trying to flee the Taliban in Afghanistan. Reporter Brian O'Connell takes up the story for us.
Peter Mulryan set up and runs the very successful Irish drinks company Blackwater Distillery, and they're based in Ballyduff Upper on the banks of the Blackwater in West Waterford. They make whiskey and gin really in a beautiful, scenic and calm location. It's about as far removed from the chaos in Kabul and elsewhere in Afghanistan at present. And yet a few days ago, he began, as you said, receiving emails that brought him right into this conflict. We met last week and in his hand, Peter had copies of emails he's been getting for the past week. And those emails are from desperate locals in Afghanistan who had confused his company with a US private military company which happened to have the same name.
We started getting emails in over a 48-hour period just before the explosion at Kabul airport. And what was unusual is that we've never received anything like this before. There were people clearly looking for Blackwater, the security firm, and they were in Afghanistan. And I don't know how they ended up with us, but they ended up sending emails to Blackwater Distillery, which is us, as opposed to the security firm.
Blackwater is a major US private security firm which is involved in operations in Iraq, Syria, obviously Afghanistan.
Exactly, which made me wonder how desperate people are if they're trying to contact a major American security firm and they end up emailing a small distillery in West Waterford. And that's what really got my attention.
And the emails were saying what?
Gosh, we got about 6 or 7 emails and stuff like this. I mean, dear sir, good afternoon. How can I receive my HR letter from Blackwater? Please send me email of Blackwater. He's worked in Afghanistan many years. They should help me. That was one. This one, my name is, I'll leave the name out, I am working in Ministry of Defence for 5 years in intelligence and CID. Now Taliban asking about me. I am very fear about it. Please help me and my family. I have worked with Blackwater Company many years, which was for Afghan National Police. I want from Blackwater to assist me. Thank you.
People pleading for help. Yeah.
Pleading for help. And there's me sitting in the office, far side of the world, reading these emails. So I thought the least I could do was respond. So I just replied to all of them going, yeah, we're not that Blackwater. We are a small drink company in Ireland. I'm really sorry for what's going on in your world. It must be desperate and I wish you well. And what's really strange is that about 3 of them replied, which I thought was bizarre. I mean, they're sitting in a war zone and they take the time out to respond to me. And they all basically said, look, thank you very much. we know you can't help us, but even just listening and sending us a response is acknowledging the pain that we're feeling. And I just thought that was, it was just very moving, actually.
So Peter was replying to these emails, which were obviously intended for this major US private military firm, Brian, but one email caught Peter's attention.
Amongst the emails he received was one from someone offering a significant amount of money for any help he could give them in getting out of Afghanistan. Such was their desperation.
This one here came just before the explosion in the airport in Kabul, and it said, "Hello, sir, madam. I have heard some news via social media that your company evacuate Afghans for $6,500 each person. If it is practicable at the moment, I am willing to pay for 8 persons to get out of here. I have worked with NATO staff since 2012. Me and my family are in danger situation, so I want to get out as soon as possible. Please contact me. Looking forward to your response."
So they were willing to pay over $50,000 to get their family out of Afghanistan.
Yeah. That was what was interesting about this one was not only that, it's an awful lot of money, but this person's English was incredibly good.
It's quite amazing, isn't it, Peter, how a series of emails sent in error takes you right into the heart of this dangerous and horrible conflict that's happening.
Yeah, completely. And what's interesting is you watch it in the news and you're kind of distant from it. Maybe think of my own family. Like, he's got 8 people to get out. That's clearly 3 generations of people. But at 3 generations, you're not going to get everyone out. So who's the aunt you leave behind? Who's the uncle you leave behind? And even the ones you don't leave behind, the ones you try to get out, you're putting them in danger as well. So wherever way you go, you're kind of in danger.
We can be so disconnected and take for granted our security, can't we?
Really, we need to get a grip. We are so, so fortunate. I don't have my family moving house to house to keep ahead of the Taliban. I was standing in my office drinking coffee, and this person was hiding in Kabul. That's the difference.
So Brian got in contact with that person in Afghanistan, willing to pay thousands to get his family out of the country.
We had a call last week and he agreed to be interviewed, and he wanted to use it as an opportunity to highlight his family's plight. So we agreed we wouldn't use his name, Claire, or say precisely where he is in Afghanistan at present. But he told me how he came to email an Irish drinks company looking for help. And he also gave me an insight into what life is like for him at the moment.
I thought that Blackwater that is company in the US. So I heard some news in social media. I thought that maybe this work for us, and maybe I can get out my family and myself from here to take to US for saving our life. So
can you tell me a little bit about your situation?
Yes, our situation is unfortunately very terrible, because you know that Afghan people who was working with NATO staff and with foreign house people and US armies are difficult to live here, because Taliban's always attacked them. We don't trust them. No one trusts them. Taliban wants to check every whom by whom to know who worked with NATO's, with Americans. They want to find them out and they want to kill them. They want to hurt their family. We had to change our place, our location. In the last 3 weeks, we changed it, our place of location 4 times in a week. We have to change 2 times in a week our location. So
you're essentially running from the Taliban.
Yes, yes, unfortunately. I have a family, 8 person family, my mother, my father, my brothers and sisters.
And you have excellent English, so did you work as an interpreter?
I was an interpreter, yes, and sometimes with the U.S. armies. We had a logistic company to supply and to support NATO armies. Since 2012, we're supporting them in supplying goods, furniture, oil, fruits, foods. Taliban came and dejected our passports after 2-3 days after Taliban coming, and embassies get closed, all embassies, and there is no way to escape to get visa now, so we are just stuck here.
That's a terrifying situation, Brian. So do they have visas now, or what's happening with them?
They have visas for Turkey, I understand. And as he said, before the Taliban took Kabul, they had sent in their visas and their passports for processing. But they were completely taken aback by the speed with which the Taliban took the city. So the embassies closed abruptly. They'd no way to get their passports or their visas back. They've also no way, by the way, of getting money out of a bank. So fleeing is really proving increasingly difficult. I did ask him to try and describe for us, Claire, how much life has changed in the past 3 weeks in comparison, say, to the past two decades. This is some of what he told me.
We lost everything. We lost our peace mind. We lost our work. We lost our education. So I was educated in international relations and master degree. My brothers also, my sister also. My sister worked with UN. My mother's worked in a school. My father's running with me in a logistic company. So all of us, all of part of family lost their jobs, we don't have anything right now just to find a way, escape from one place to another place, just keep our safe life, and that's all. So 100% our life changed. We lost everything. It's a very difficult situation for us. I have documents. My father have documents. My mother have documents that work with, and I have documents that work with NATO forces. So we just collect our documents and send to every embassy in Kabul. But unfortunately, because the situation was very bad condition, so no one didn't help us. And we hope that we find a sponsorship from Europe countries or from US that they help us, because in the last 10 years, 8 years, we helped them a lot.
What about the option of traveling by land? I would assume it's very dangerous.
There is no option, unfortunately. There is no option even in land. Uzbekistan border is closed. Pakistan border is closed. Iran border is closed. At the moment, there is no flight by the sky. There is no way out in the land. So there is no way out for the moment. So that's hard for every people, every Afghan zero stack here.
That report from Brian O'Connell from Today with Claire Byrne. And on the Ryan Tuberty Show, actor and writer Jade Jordan was Ryan's guest, and she was talking about colour and Irishness, her grandmother's life married to a black man in the 60s, and her own story dealing with everyday racism.
So last March, the whole world was hit with a lockdown, and we kind of didn't know where we sat, what we were doing, how long we'd be in it for. And I, 2016, I started recording my granny, asking her questions about her past and her history.
Why?
Because I was intrigued.
Yeah.
I was intrigued. I wanted to know more. I really, really wanted to know more. So I started recording her, popped up a tripod camera, started asking her questions of her past. And as you know, life takes over. You put things on the shelf, and I did for years. Mm-hmm. And then in lockdown, I was like, what am I going to do with my time like everyone else? So I started delving into these videos, picking them apart. And then George Floyd incident happened.
Yeah.
So the family story is my granny married a black man in the 60s, which at that time was actually illegal to marry.
Illegal.
It was illegal in America still.
Yeah.
And I was just really intrigued, and just really, as an actor, I think it's really important. You need to know where you come from. You need to know your roots.
Okay, let's as they say, unpack all of this. Right.
There's so much
in that, but you've given us a great sense of where we're going to go this morning for starters. So you're an actor, obviously, which gets us off the ground in terms of what you do. George Floyd was, to me, reading your story, a trigger to collate your family history. You almost did a self, who do you think you are? Who do I think I am?
Yeah.
On the whole story. And that brings us back, in some ways, not so much to your grandmother. I was interested in your great-grandmother for a moment. Tell me about her, because her attitude to your story informs everything that happened afterwards. So tell me about her a little bit.
Yeah, well, you know, Nanny, kind of, I would probably call her a rebel, because you didn't see a white woman back in marrying a black man all those years ago.
Yeah.
She lived in the UK at the time and never told her family that she had got wed.
Okay.
And she did come home for a visit and said it just before she was about to get on a train, and there was no response. So I think she kind of knew the answer without anything being said, that it wasn't accepted.
By her own mother.
By her own mother, yeah. And when she moved home, her mother passed away. But there was never any acceptance there. My nanny's husband was never a part of the family. And yeah, they just weren't accepted, you know. And that was what kind of, I couldn't fathom all of those things, you know.
Yeah.
We're in 2021 now. There's not a lot that we can't do. You okay. know what I mean?
I do, of course. So that brings us to your grandmother then, who met your grandfather. How much information did you manage to garner about all their meeting and their lives together?
With the great-great-grandmother? No, with the great-mother?
With actually your grandmother.
With my grandmother?
Yeah, Nanny.
How did they meet?
Yes.
So Nanny moved over to be a nurse, and they met through a friend, and it kind of just escalated. I think he kind of had an eye on my granny, and my nanny's really, really quiet, and she always called herself a bit of a loner, actually.
Yeah.
And it kind of, they went to cinema dates, they went on drives, and it kind of started there. Okay. But she never seen anything. My nanny's the type of person that never seen colour.
Yes.
You know, and throughout the book, I ask her questions. And I can't understand that. I'm like, surely back in the day, there would have been judgment or there would have been comments passed. But she doesn't see that. Now, that's the thing. Maybe she's chosen not to see that.
Yeah.
Maybe that's a thing of the past and she forgets it or just chose to forget it for a reason. You know, you've got to understand that as well. But that wasn't my family's experience. They had comments and judgment and questions. But maybe Nanny just chose to not see that. I don't think she chose to ignore it.
But she ploughed on, regardless.
She ploughed on, yeah, she ploughed on.
And Jade spoke about the family's return to Ireland.
I think when she first moved back, it was new. There was questions. But she's like my granny, she's a strong, strong woman.
What questions?
So I think she always had, were you adopted?
Yeah.
You know, the usual people touching your hair.
I want to ask you about that.
Yeah.
Because your mother would have come back to a Dublin, a very white, monochrome, monocultural city.
Yeah.
And with that comes, as you say, questions. And this is a new one on me because I know that it's become a talking point with other commentators. Hair touching.
Yeah, it's a thing.
What is that?
It's actually a thing.
I don't understand it. You'll have to explain it to me.
I know people are intrigued because, you know, our hairs are big and they're different texture. Yeah, different colours.
Like it's beautiful and everything, but, yeah. But to want to touch somebody else's head?
I don't know. I've never had the need or the compulsion to touch anybody's head.
No.
You know, yet again, it comes with, depends on the mood that you're in. Sometimes okay. You might go, no, of course you can't touch my hair.
Yeah.
And then other times you're like, it really depends where you are, you know. But that's actually a thing.
This is the thing for you now
this
as well.
This is a thing, yeah. Yeah. I get it all the time.
And you say
sometimes in a queue, you're like, no, you can't touch my hair.
Do people ask you, sorry, I'm bouncing back to you. We'll come back to your mum and Sean McDermott in a second. But do people ask you, may I, or do they just do it?
Years ago, people used to just do it. I think maybe because you were a kid.
Yeah.
Now there's the, you know, people are reluctant because you're an adult.
Yeah.
And you can tell them to no, don't.
I'm trying to buy a smoothie.
Yeah, that's not okay. I'm in the middle of ordering Americano here, thanks.
Okay. So your mum arrives back and she's sitting there and they're asking questions. Are you adopted? Can I touch your hair? And how did she manage with all that? Was it an issue for her or did she just keep going?
Well, I think she struggled. Of course. You definitely struggle, but the type of person that my mom was, I think she was a grown up ahead of her years.
Okay.
You know, so she was well able for it. You know, she was well able for it and well able to answer them back and give them the answers they looked for. But that was a major, major question all the time. Like my granny had it, a white woman, snow white hair with three children of colour.
Yeah.
Like one of the comments I remember my nanny telling me before was she was standing in a shop window, and I'm pretty sure it was in Galway, and somebody said, Jesus, aren't you so good to be taking the kids out for the day? Who owns them? And my nanny was like, well, they're mine.
Yeah.
You know, there was this, I suppose, shock.
Do you think that's racism or innocence?
You know, people might argue with me here. I think whatever way it's asked, it can be racism or it can be people that are just intrigued.
Yeah.
You know, but there's a way of asking those questions.
I think definitely when we get to your generation, because your book is about three generations. When we get to yours, we'll focus on that.
Yeah, of course. Yeah,
but
yeah.
Let's stick with your mum, which is a slightly different time. They relocated to from the flats because they were they demolished those.
They
the
were
flats?
Demolished, yeah.
And then out to Blanchardstown.
Yeah.
Which I've spoken to people over the years, and they said, yeah, the flats were difficult and the tenements were awful and so on, but the move to Blanchardstown was unsettling, actually, and it wasn't easy.
Absolutely. Well, it was a massive move. You think from the inner city now to Blanchardstown is probably 20 minutes in a car.
Yeah.
I remember my mum saying that was hours. I remember they were first off at a house in Talla, and I remember my nanny saying at the time, God, you'd get to America quicker. Because it was the sticks and it was the countryside years ago. But there was a thing in the inner city, which there was this massive, as much as they struggled, there was this massive community.
Yes.
Like the inner city, you were a family, you were all together.
I'm thinking of Washington Heights, you know.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Everyone out there, like Sesame Street, you know.
Yeah.
Everyone knows everyone and...
Everybody knows each other.
Has your back in a sense.
And if, you know, it's the little things. Everyone used to watch each other and the women, it got like I paint pictures in the book, of the women going down the stairs in the morning.
Yeah.
Going to sell their fruit and veg, like such a working class community. And Blanchardstown had that. I think it was just a shock.
Yeah, to
the inner city when they moved out to Blanche, you know.
And Jade spoke about the struggles her mother faced.
Well, when they first moved out to Blanchardstown, my granny went to try and get my mum into a secondary school. And the secondary school mum went up with her and she said, look, can we enrol? And she was told, no, there's no space. That was fine. They walked away. I guess they would have went to another school. But they started chatting to the neighbour. I think the thing was, they always thought when people moved out from these areas that nobody would really mix for a long time. But everyone started chatting, where are you coming from, whatever. And this lady happened to say to my nanny, oh, I've just got my daughter, who was my mum's age at the time, into a school. And my nanny said, what school? Told her. And she was like, well, that's funny. I was just up there today and there was no spaces. So obviously my nanny digested that, went up to the school on the Monday morning or whatever. And she said, you told me there was no spaces. You know, what is the problem? Somebody else is just being accepted and a number of kids have just started being accepted into the school. Is it a colour thing? So anyway, with that, they took Mam. And her life was just horrific when she was in secondary school.
First of all, the nanny.
Yeah.
Going up saying, no, not taking no for an answer.
Yeah, yeah, strong.
That's gutsy. Right, absolutely. I love that. Love that. Got the place. But now you're dealing with the day-to-day stuff then.
Yeah. I mean, there was this nun in Pacific that I speak about in the book. And yet again, it probably was a race thing. But, you know, back in the UK, Mam didn't learn religion. So she just constantly picked on Mam and, you know, gave her such a hard time about it. To the point where there was a confrontation and they actually told Mam to leave.
Okay.
With that, Mam obviously accepted that, which you would, but all the community came behind. So the children of Mam's class were going home and saying, look, Dominique is being treated like this, I've noticed this. And they all rallied together and came up to the school and said, no, this has been going on for months, this treatment.
That's pretty impressive.
Absolute months. And that's not acceptable.
And Jade spoke about being black and Irish.
When I finished drama school, I came to filling out my CV before our showcase.
Yes.
And I ticked a box and I ticked white Irish. And I remember my teacher at the time going, what are you doing? And I was like, I'm ticking my box. And she couldn't understand. In her brain, she was like, but you're mixed race.
Yeah.
And I said, yeah, I don't have a mixed race Irish box. I never want to lose my Irish identity. I'm Irish.
Yeah. What are the boxes?
So years ago, you had mixed race, you had black, you had Hispanic.
Yeah.
You so many different, but you never had, on our forms, you never had mixed race Irish or black Irish.
Yeah.
You were just white Irish.
White Irish.
which is bizarre. Yeah. And for me, I never want to lose that. I'm so proud to be Irish. Why would I want to lose that side of me?
When was the last time, Jade, somebody made a racial slur against you?
December.
And we're now in...
September.
Thank you. 2021. Can I ask you what happened?
Yep, absolutely. I was actually on the way to the Abbey and I was coming out of there and I... Christmas shopping. You know that when you jaunt in people's ways and you both get in each other's way and I went, oh, excuse me. And he turned around and said, "You stupid." The N-word.
Really?
And you know, I walked off. And then it kind of registered, because I haven't been called that for a very long time. And it kind of registered with me what had happened. I thought, hold on a second here, I'm not standing for that. So I walked back and tipped him on the shoulder. I said, "How dare you? How dare you? You know, you could have called me anything else. Why did that have to be the first thing that you went to?"
I'm dying to know what he said.
You know,
what did he say to you?
Do you know what he did? No. He put his head down and couldn't even answer.
Mortified.
Absolutely mortified. Yeah. And I just thought, like, I actually felt really sorry for him when I went away and digested it.
Because he's pathetic.
I felt really sorry for him, because I thought, what is going on in that man's life? Yeah. There's so much anger in him.
Yeah.
Do you know?
Yeah.
So,
and so much bad
you have
blood.
To kind of, over time, you have to kind of change the narrative and go, right, actually, why is that person doing that?
Yeah.
Do you know what I mean?
Yeah.
It comes to a point where you can't take all that on and try and understand it. You just have to go, I understand that you're in a bad place right now.
Yeah, the perpetrator is the problem, not the victim.
Absolutely.
In all of these cases.
Yeah.
But particularly like that. But if I was related to you, or, you know, in your life, and I heard that, I'd be really upset. As well as angry and furious, but I'd be upset that you, if you were to come home and say this happened today, I'd also feel upset that Ireland still has that knocking around.
Yeah, I know. Well, you know, I wouldn't really, but I actually took to social media with it, and people were just like, "What? That's still a thing?" And I was like, "Yes, it is." People use them words so flippantly. It's just.
When was the last time your mother got a racial slur against her?
In June.
June just gone by. Yeah. What happened?
My friend is a yoga teacher, and she teaches gong meditation. And we were going to do a retreat on a beach in Wicklow.
So you're bound for Zen.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay, gotcha.
Bring it on.
Yeah.
And gorgeous day, actually the hottest day of the year. And the traffic was absolutely crazy. Mm-hmm. Going into the car park, the police had stopped. The police were manning it and everything. The police were there, packed. And man was slowly going into this space, and this fella was tooting his horn behind her, and he put his head out the window and turned around and said, "I knew you would be an effing N."
No.
The police were there though.
In what sense?
The police were standing there manning the traffic, and they heard us.
Did they?
Yeah.
What happened next?
Absolutely nothing was done.
Oh no.
Nothing.
Nanny, Ma and Me is the name of the book. That's Jay Jordan on the Ryan Tubridy Show. And back to the live line with Philippa Outer-Hayes and callers talking about breast cancer. Philippa was in her 30s when she was diagnosed with breast cancer.
36 years of age with a 5-year-old daughter.
I think the amazing thing here is, well, you tell me, did the fake tan save your life, or would you have realised that something was wrong before too long?
I think anybody who knows me would know that I'm a splash dash kind of rushing around the place person. And we were going out for Valentine's dinner, and I was wearing a low V frontage, let's say, pantsuit. So as many women out there, as particularly with young children, realise, the bit of tan was thrown on only parts that can be seen. So the arms, the feet, the ankles, and the V of the neck. But when I was putting on the false tan, I felt a thickening in my right breast, which I hadn't felt before, and I thought it was unusual. But as we were rushing out the door, I didn't put much more on it.
And was that all over the breast, or was it localised to the area of a lump? What was it? What did it feel like?
No, it was from the nipple, say, up to nearly my armpit.
Good Lord, okay.
Yeah, and it was kind of...
Hard to the touch?
No, not hard to it. I was about to say, if you can imagine what I would imagine a piece of liver or a breast of chicken to feel under your skin. It was that sensation. It was harder, it was denser, but it was, I could move it and it was pliable. So I didn't go to, oh, that's a lump. I was going, oh, maybe this is something related to menstrual cycles or, you know.
And how large was it, Philippa?
To the touch, I'd say we were probably 3 inches in length by an inch width. That's what it felt.
And you'd never noticed this before?
No, never noticed. Again, Katie Louise, I just was 36. There's no history of breast cancer in my family. Never would have checked myself. I would have seen ads and billboards and Breast Cancer Month, and I would go, oh God, yeah, I must do that. And it just, you're rushing in your race, and you're 36 and you've a young family and you've work and your life, and you're just not thinking of checking your breasts. But
and
my
you
husband,
had never, ever, mother, ever, ever before that checked your breast, no?
No, good never. Lord. And it was just literally putting on that bit of false tan, bit of pride to put on the false tan to go out to Valentine's.
Imagine if you had worn a different top.
If I had worn a pullover or a polar neck, I'd never know. But I'm sure, obviously, I would have. I was told that I was extremely lucky and somebody was definitely praying for me. We went out that night, and my husband had said to me, I said it to him, he said, you should get it checked, because my mother had just recovered from bowel cancer. But even though there was no link between breast and bowel, I tipped over to my GP. And I left my GP again. You're too young. You have no history. I wouldn't be worried about it. It could be a bit of a cyst. It could be related to your menopausal cycle. And so I left, went to the GP, said I left with a bit of reassurance. I did have a referral letter to see a breast specialist. I got an appointment a week later. And I went in. I had a clinical assessment by a lovely doctor. He felt what I felt, said, I'm going to send you down for a mammogram. Thankfully, I was able to avail of the triple assessment, the best care for breast cancer practice. When they'd done the mammogram, they saw the abnormality, and then I was straight in for a biopsy. And still, like Kellyanne, I was in a world of my own going, yeah, this is nothing to come on. I have things to be doing, a place to go, a child to be collected, and the dinner
really,
to be doing.
Really?
I was so, like, not thinking.
This is not going to be me. This is not what's
in
my future.
No, I'm fit. I'm healthy. I'm strong. I'm young. It's not in my family. Because I have friends where it is in their family. And I've gone, like, this is just not me. And then I got a phone call about a week later to go back. I was told I had stage 2 breast cancer. My tumour was oestrogen positive and HER2 positive. And on the 2nd of March, so about 4 days after that, I had a partial mastectomy and lymph node removal.
And Philippa was thinking of Sarah Harding's story.
I was thinking of Sarah Harding because I had been following her. And like anybody who's had a young diagnosis of cancer, let alone breast cancer, like, I've watched and been following Sarah. The same with Emma Hannigan. I have such admiration for her, and indeed Keelan Shanley, to name but a few, sadly, that have gone before us. And it's, you know, I feel sorry for Sarah. Like, she, you know, she never married, like, obviously I don't know her, but, you know, she never married. She always came across like a fun girl, bit of like frail sometimes. She had her issues, but I just think, you know, if she was helped a bit earlier. I was reading that her, you know, she found lumps in 2019 under her armpits.
She put them off because of COVID and hospitals, and she didn't want to go into them.
So she had got that help 8 months. So that kind of then makes me go, you're blessed. You know, you're alive. You've married, your daughter, you know, she hadn't got that opportunity, and you should be grateful. But another part of me, when you say it's chipper, another part of me, and I think most women that you'll talk to, or indeed anybody who's had a cancer diagnosis, you're never the same.
You do live with
an element of fear of, oh God, if this comes back. And I, particularly because I ended up having to have the hysterectomy and oophorectomy, I couldn't have any more children. I was told not to delay my treatment, to start my treatment straight away, not to even be bothering, you know, with freezing eggs, because to live for the child I had, not to be hoping that I'd have more, which was a lot to take. But now, like, I do fear that if it comes back, she's on her own. And that to me that's the bit that breaks my heart.
And in your case, what are the chances of that happening now? Or have they given you a clean bill of health?
I'm on tamoxifen now. I have to take that for 5 years, which to dampen down any of the estrogen receptors that within my body. And the reason I had the 26 rounds of Herceptin is that the tumour was also HER2 positive, and that scatters in the blood. So the idea was that all the chemo I had chased down any cells that had escaped or showered into the blood. So I've had all my mammograms to date are clean. I have a checkup with my oncologist every 6 months, and then I have yearly checkups with my breast specialist, and on that date I get my mammogram as well. But I'm very fortunate that I have got health insurance, and that if I do worry or if I'm panicked about anything, I know I can pick up that phone and ring the secretary and go, look, I feel this, I feel that, I just want to get it checked.
Well, that's Philippa on the live line with Philip Boucher-Hayes. And in the morning, every parent's worst nightmare, Pat and Cathy O'Sullivan spoke to Claire about an horrific road accident where, after falling from his bike, their 8-year-old son's head went under the wheel of a passing truck. And it all happened when they were on holiday on Valentia Island.
Pat is from Valentia, so we were down with the grandparents and the rest of the family for a couple of weeks.
So it was the 9th of August then, Pat, and you decided that you would go on a cycle.
That's right, yeah. We just decided there late morning that all five of us were going to head out for a little bit of a cycle before lunchtime. You know, just something to pass a bit of time. You know, making plans for the afternoon, maybe we'll go to the beach, who knows. But I guess you don't think about what can potentially be coming down the tracks. So off we headed for our cycle anyway, down towards Knightstown, which is the main village there in Valentia. And we were travelling at a slightly different pace, you know, so Roisin, our youngest, was going quite slowly. So Cathy ended up hanging back with her, and I ended up cycling ahead with Maeve, our eldest, and Padraig. And just as we were coming into Knightstown, cycling along nice and slowly into the village, a truck passed us by on the right-hand side. And whether it was just the sight of the truck in his peripheral vision, or he just got a little bit of a fright, Padraig, who was right in front of me, just took a wobble on his bike, just literally as the truck was passing by, and fell out onto the road and went in under the back wheels of the truck. You know, and it all happened in the blink of an eye.
Was Maeve in front?
Maeve was in front, yeah. So Maeve had gone out in front, and she was waiting for us when we arrived down to the village, and then she just rejoined us there. So she was in front.
Well, Padraig, she was way ahead.
I was cycling right behind him then.
So the truck comes along, and poor just wobbled. And I've seen this. I have an 8-year-old myself. I know how easily it can happen, and your heart is in your mouth as you're cycling along. But the worst thing happened. He fell and in under the wheels.
In under the wheel of the truck, yeah. Now, we were fortunate in many respects. But the truck was travelling nice and slowly, which was great, and it was heading in the same direction as we were travelling too. And the driver was very, very aware that he was passing children, you know, so he was watching his mirror, and as soon as he saw Padraig wobble and fall, he hit the brakes. Now, that wasn't quick enough that the wheel didn't, unfortunately, go over Padraig's head, but I think it all helped.
Pat, are clear, the wheel of the truck went over his head.
It did.
Could you see that happening?
I was 6 feet behind him, looking right at us, you know, close enough almost to reach out and touch him, but not quite close enough to do anything about it. Yeah.
And Cathy, could you see all this happening?
No, I was back the road, a good bit back the road at Roisin, so I had no idea that it was happening.
Okay.
Something Pat said before was, when you're cycling with children, just after this, that you think because they're so close to you that you're in control of the situation, but really you don't have any control over it, you know.
It's so true, isn't it? It is so true. You just, when something like that happens, you there's nothing you can do really in that moment.
No, absolutely not. Yeah.
You sent us in a photograph, Pat, of the helmet afterwards. And when I saw this on Friday in the office, I held my breath. When I saw it, it's in 18 pieces.
That's right. Yeah. Yeah. The helmet was completely crushed under the wheel of the truck. And it it just proves the point for me that were he not wearing the helmet, we would certainly be looking at a very different outcome. Mm-hmm. Very, very different outcome. Mm-hmm.
Tell me what happened then once this incident occurred. He's lying on the ground. The helmet is smashed to bits. You obviously went straight away to see how he was. Was he conscious at that point?
Not immediately. No. He was out of it for a brief period of time. I couldn't say exactly how long. Seconds kind of bled into hours at that stage. But certainly for a short period of time, he was unconscious. I suppose in a panic, I did all of the wrong things. I picked him up and took him out from under the wheel of the truck and moved him to the side of the road. There was some of the nearby neighbours had witnessed what had happened and were straight on to dial the emergency services. One of the other ways we got incredibly lucky is the first person walking by the scene happened to be a nurse. So she was able to come and help us immediately. One of the nearby neighbours was able to call an off-duty paramedic who was on the beach with his kids, but dropped everything and rushed to the scene as quickly as possible as well. So, mm-hmm. We were blessed with all the help.
We were lucky.
All the help that we got.
And Cathy spoke about the air ambulance arriving at the scene.
And then the air ambulance arrived. So we were incredibly fortunate that the air ambulance was available at the time. So they were about 25 minutes out from Valencia when they got the call. The nearest road ambulance was going to be at least 45 minutes. So we were very lucky with that. And once they arrived, I mean, they're just an amazing service. They just took control of the situation. They were able to check Padraig out and they were very reassuring to us at the time that they didn't think that he was too badly injured.
And they were able to land in a garden of a house right beside where you were.
That's right.
We were just where the accident happened, just by pure happenstance, was outside the garden of a gentleman who lives on the island who worked for many years in the Irish Lights, and historically he would have been picked up by helicopter from his front garden to be taken to lighthouses around the coast, the offshore rocks and so on. So we knew the helicopters could land in that garden, as we'd seen them land there many times before. And when he rang the emergency services, he was able to advise them of that fact as well, so that they knew that they had a landing site for the helicopter right beside where the accident had happened. Mm-hmm. So just another one of the ways we got very, very lucky.
And Pat, Cathy was saying there how reassuring the paramedic was, the paramedic who arrived on that helicopter. Do you agree that really calmed the situation?
They were unbelievable. You know, I couldn't say enough positive things about the team. There was, the pilot and the two advanced paramedics that were on the helicopter were amazing. Just the level of calmness, the professionalism, the obvious skill that they had was so reassuring at a point where we were obviously at our wit's end. And the fact that they were able to, they did all the. It took a period of time to go through the necessary triage and the treatment and to get him stabilised. And they were taking no chances. So obviously he was put in neck braces and spinal boards and so on. Mm-hmm. But all throughout the process, they talked us through it. They reassured us. They were able to tell us that okay, we're taking this very seriously because we see what's happened here. But we're hopeful that he's going to be okay. Then they had to make a decision as to which hospital to bring him to, and obviously the closest acute trauma centre was in Cork, so they were able to make the call there and then that they were going to get him to Cork University Hospital. They talked us through their decision making process the whole way. They were unbelievably good. I couldn't say enough.
And you, Pat, went on the helicopter with Padraig.
I did. Yeah, I did indeed.
Cathy, it's harder for the person left behind, is it?
Yeah, well, watching your child disappear off on a helicopter that becomes a little dot in the sky and disappears was a bit traumatic. But at the same time, I really felt he was in such safe hands and in the right place.
So how's Padraig doing now?
He's back at school. He's in great form. He's a very chilled out character. So he took it all in his stride. he's a little bit of a sore arm, but it's all healing up nicely. And
okay.
It's fine.
What's his recollection of it all, or does he remember?
He remembers wobbling on his bike, and he remembers waking up. That's all he remembers. Mm-hmm. So, mm-hmm. Which is probably for the best. And he remembers the ceiling of the helicopter.
I see. I don't know if I'll ever let my children out on a road on their bikes now after listening to this ever again. Will you?
We're hoping now he'll get back on it for a little cycle soon. He doesn't seem fazed by that.
Well, that's good.
It's
good, but it's a great warning, and it's a great reminder about the importance of helmets. I'm getting so many text messages in here, people saying that helmets should be compulsory. Other people saying it's important to know that cycle helmets have a life cycle. They don't last forever. Always check the date on the helmet and so on.
Cathy and Pat O'Sullivan from Today with Claire Byrne. And back to those breast cancer stories on the live line. Orla called Philip about her story.
Orla, tell me, in your case, the mammogram missed something that an ultrasound picked up.
Yes, they actually did two mammograms, and it was a little bit hazy looking, so they did the ultrasound as well on the same day.
Okay. And is that something that's common? Because I had always thought that the mammogram was the sort of the gold standard of these things. But what was it that it didn't detect in your case?
Well, I actually didn't have a lump at all. So, my right breast was a tiny bit swollen on the side, like I'd gotten a knock or something like that.
Right.
So when I went down to the doctor, she said, I asked my husband and he said, I can see, but it's nothing. Went down to my doctor. She said, I see what you're saying, but it's nothing. So 2 weeks later, I went into the hospital and they said the exact same. I can see what you're talking about, but it's nothing. And then he said, I'm going to get the consultant to check it.
And Orla, were you pushing all the time? Were you saying, no, I'm
not
sorry,
at all.
I think it's something?
No. This is all within 2 weeks. You know, it was my doctor. I went down to get bloods done. I said, have a look at this. And then she said, I'll send you in for a breast check. You know, just to be on the safe side. And then I went in 2 weeks later for a breast check. And the first doctor was like, no, I don't think it's something. I just have to get somebody else to have a look. And the second guy saw something. So I went down for a mammogram. They did a second mammogram. And then they did a ultrasound. And then they did a biopsy. And I actually, to be honest with you, just thought I was getting great service. You know, I kind of skipped in, skipped out.
Okay.
And it was when I was leaving, they gave me a letter to hand in to the consultant, and I handed it in. And I said, look, I'm going, whatever. And she said, no, the consultant wants to see you. And I said, but I saw him earlier on, you know. And he just said, sit down. He said, like, you know, this is serious.
You were not in a place to be receiving this news. You were not expecting this at all.
Not at all. I was smiling under my mask, and I was like, whatever. And I kind of left. It was the Tuesday before Easter. So I had to wait till the Tuesday after Easter. So they confirmed it was cancer, and it was 3 centimetres. It was kind of more like, it's called a diffuse kind of cloud. So it was 3 centimetres. Then they did the CT scan. It was 9 centimetres. So it meant when they did a mastectomy. And when they did the mastectomy, then they took it out, and it was actually 14 centimetres. So, I was really lucky, though, because it went around my lymph nodes, but actually couldn't get into my lymph nodes. So it's just in the one area.
And did they remove lymph nodes as well?
They removed 3. Yeah, they removed 3.
And explain to me then, after the surgery, where does that lymph go? Because presumably that area can still fill up with fluids, no?
To be honest with you, I wasn't really worried about the lymph nodes. They were gone within 2 weeks. It was the whole mastectomy that I was kind of worried about. Once they took it, so they removed all the cancer. So I'm starting my chemo and my radiation cancer-free. So, you know, I'm very lucky that way. They did a thing called an Onca test, so the likelihood of the cancer ever coming back to me is 16%.
So, sorry, Orla, I'm just getting the picture now. Silly me.
Yeah.
You are right in the middle of all of this. How recently was the mastectomy?
Oh, yeah. Sorry. So I went in on the 30th of March this year, and within 36 days they had removed my breast. They actually did a JEP reconstruction, so it was like an 8-hour procedure. So they rebuild your breast with your stomach muscles. So I've been for a week.
Have you started chemo yet?
I've done 3 of my 8, and it's gone really, really well. Kind of okay for me. I'm starting my radiation tomorrow.
Because the second person I've said this today, you're also sounding pretty chipper for somebody who's in the middle of chemo.
You know what? I'm so lucky. It was, you know, that poor girl passed away yesterday. I We found it. I'm fine. I wasn't sick. I was walking 10 kilometres every morning. There was never one morning that I said I was tired. Apparently, it had been growing for 2 years. And,
No family history, nothing.
Orla on the live line with Philip Boucher-Hayes. Now, back in mid-May, the HSE was the victim of a cyber attack that caused huge amounts of disruption and distress for many patients. So on Today with Claire Byrne, Detective Chief Superintendent Paul Cleary was talking about catching up with the cyber criminals.
Now, the operation began weeks ago. You've been working closely with Interpol, Europol and other international police forces. What can you tell us about how this investigation is proceeding against this particular gang involved in the HSE attack?
Well, the investigation, as you said, is ongoing for a number of weeks now, and it's progressing well. We have, as you've said, launched a disruption operation, and essentially what that means is that we have been able to identify the technical infrastructure utilised by this gang suspected of being behind the HSE attack. And I suppose essentially what we did was we identified the servers, the domains, the websites, and we took them over. And what the gang would have used these for is when they are in the early stages of a potential ransomware attack, unsuspecting victims who may have clicked on an attachment would have been redirected to this infrastructure and these domains. And then at that stage, then they would have downloaded further malicious code unknowingly necessary to complete the attack. But what we have done in the Garda National Cybercrime Bureau is take over these domains. And when unsuspecting victims are redirected to these sites, they will now see what we call an alert splash screen telling them that the Irish Police and Garda Síochána have taken over these domains and that they should immediately check their IT systems and networks because they may be compromised.
Okay.
To date, we know that 753 potential new unsuspecting victims would have been redirected to the site that we had taken over and would have seen this alert screen warning them.
And those potential victims were worldwide?
All around the world, different countries, a number of different jurisdictions. And they would have seen our splash screen. And obviously, we would work very closely with our law enforcement partners around the world and also in Europol and Interpol.
I know we're getting cleverer with this, but even on an individual basis, not on a corporate basis, we all seem to be getting more text messages, more emails attempting to get into our systems, Paul, than ever before.
Absolutely. The rapidly progressing digitalisation of society, it presents endless new opportunities for cyber criminals, and they do take advantage of the situation. You know, we will have all got these text messages and these phishing and smishing messages, and it is a challenge. And it is a challenge for us here in the Garda National Cybercrime Bureau. We can only work effectively within our jurisdiction, and unfortunately a lot of these messages are emanating from outside the jurisdiction, so we're depending on our law enforcement partners in other countries to chase this down for us. But I think it's more than a law enforcement issue. You know, we're dealing with the telcos, the telecom operators and the messaging platforms, you know, to try and look upstream of this problem.
Detective Chief Superintendent Paul Cleary from Today with Claire Byrne. And that's it for Payback Daily, so mind yourself till next time.